This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Metro North derailments, CT fast track progress, transit oriented development, the safety of our bridges and roads, the I-84 viaduct. We never tire of talking transit here on Where We Live. Today's a good day for it. As the snow falls outside, thousands worry about their afternoon commute. Here to answer lots of questions about the state's transportation system is James Redeker. He's the commissioner of the DOT. You can join our conversation. What questions do you have for the commissioner? How can we make Metro North better? That's how we're going to start. 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. You can email wherewelive@wnpr.org. You can tweet us at Where We Live, or you can follow along on WNPR.org. We are going to focus this first segment on Metro North, a commuter line that has been coming under a lot of criticism recently. This past year has seen a fatal derailment on the Hudson Line, a power outage that shut down New Haven Line trains for days, another crash in Bridgeport that injured dozens, and this comes amidst passenger complaints over slow service and crowded trains. Are the rails themselves in good enough shape? And what can Connecticut do to make Metro North better? That was a show that we held last week, and we got a lot of ideas for Jim Redeker. Again, you can join us 860-275-7266. But I want to welcome the commissioner, and thank you so much for coming here today.
Good morning. It's great to be here. Thank you.
I also want to welcome in the cameras of CTN, the Connecticut Network. They're taping today's show for future broadcast. So first of all, why don't you explain the role the DOT plays in overseeing Metro North? How does this work?
Sure. For those who don't know, Connecticut owns the Northeast Corridor, the rail line between New Haven and the New York border. That's an unusual relationship. Most of the rest of the Northeast Corridor is owned by Amtrak. When the state entered into that purchase agreement and ownership agreement back in the 80s, we also entered into an agreement with Metro North to operate that service. It's a joint service. Obviously, it runs between Connecticut and New York into Grand Central Terminal. We have a relationship with them where they are essentially our contracted operator. So we enter into agreements each year for budgets and service and fares. They provide the service. And then the Connecticut DOT actually oversees that relationship, oversees capital construction projects, and then Metro North delivers the service. They are a full-service provider. They're responsible for operations and maintenance. They're responsible for customer service and for planning and for capital programming. So it's a pretty extensive relationship. Metro North is a terrific railroad. It's been a tough year for them.
It has been a tough year, and we'll talk a bit about how we can improve what's been happening over the course of this last year. But just so that our listeners who don't follow this on a daily basis understand, when you say capital improvements and other things, we own in Connecticut, we own the rails that they're riding on.
We own the rails. We own the wires. We own the tracks. We own
the trains.
All the cars. We own the yards. We own everything there is to run the railroad. So that's a large responsibility. Connecticut, as a result, is the one who finances all those investments. We have put in place over $3 billion in the last 10 years or so. That's a significant investment in that infrastructure. And I think people are seeing many of the benefits of those investments. So as of today, for example, we're up over 320 new M8 cars, moving toward our goal of 405 or so. That'll give us a complete new fleet by the end of 2015. Your chances today are about 7 out of 10 chances you're going to get on a new vehicle. So those kinds of improvements supported by all new overhead wire. We're engaged in the last piece of that this coming year. We'll be starting the last phase of all that replacement. We're replacing the maintenance facility in New Haven. And there are lots of things that are underway that are improving service. Let me just be specific about two major projects that I think talk to one of the issues we faced just recently, which was the power outage.
Yes.
Substation in New York in Mount Vernon was under upgrade. It was planned. It was intentional. And through some human error, the substation went out of service and we lost power. Connecticut is investing in two substations, one in Coscob and one in New Haven. The way we will do those will avoid any of the problems that we had in New York and provide complete redundant power throughout and across the entire New Haven line. So we're taking proactive steps to put this right away and this system in the best possible state.
One of the concerns that came up over and over again during the last conversation we had about Metro North, and something that we've heard about from those who follow the commuter line pretty closely over the course of the last couple of years, is while these investments are being made now, a lot of this has been deferred over time, that we haven't invested over time in this rail service the way we should, so that the tracks aren't as in as good a shape as they should be. We don't have as many new cars as we should. How do you address that particular concern? I mean, do we need to ramp up more investment in our rail service right now than we have?
Yeah, so let me just speak to that a bit. Frankly, in the last 4 years, in this current administration and legislative sessions, we have almost quadrupled the resources into the railroad. So significantly more money recently has been going in. That is in part to address what is a major backlog. Connecticut and, frankly, all of New England has an infrastructure, and it doesn't matter which mode you talk about. It could be highways and bridges. It could be railroads or public transit. We have a very old infrastructure. So, indeed, Connecticut has, as an owner of a rail line, but as part of the Northeast Corridor Network, a rather significant backlog. There's a, in Connecticut alone, we face probably a $3 billion need to replace movable bridges and systems and signal systems. Many of those are programmed in our program, and so we'll be advancing those. We are also advocating significantly for federal funding. This is a time when Congress is about to take up the issue of reauthorizing the funding source for Amtrak and the Northeast Corridor. And as chairman now of the Northeast Corridor Commission, I have a very significant opportunity to influence that and to work with my partners along the Northeast Corridor to get federal funding into the corridor. We're also working toward new mixes of funding, state contributions from other states that have not been there before, as well as Amtrak and federal sources. So there is a need. What we're trying to do is keep pace with the backlog, to keep the system in a good state of repair. And as we're doing that, upgrade our systems. So, for example, one of the calls for action after the derailment that just happened last weekend was investment in positive train control, or PTC. Connecticut, the DOT, has invested already in positive train control. We believe in safety. We believe that's a critical system. And we will actually be piloting for the Metro North system, the first phase of that system on the eastern end of our system from New Haven into Bridgeport. So in a way, to demonstrate our commitment to safety, we're the first to go, if you will, on the Metro North system.
And these are safety changes that are coming in the wake of this latest derailment
that are being forced by the regulators? Not at all. It's a recommendation that's been made. There's a federal law to invest in positive train control. We've embraced that. We've endorsed it. Our capital program has $160 million to fully implement positive train control for our rail system.
Just so that people understand, that, what are some of the changes that are coming after this derailment? I know that regulators took a look at this. They had some pretty harsh words for Metro North about different safety issues. What's happening after that? How soon will these things be in place?
Yeah. So, frankly, immediately after the May 17th derailment, and, you know, I was there on site as soon as it happened, we began our partnership with Metro North in addressing issues and concerns. Metro North took, I think, very proactive action on our part. They're a railroad that takes safety seriously. They've engaged an organization called Transportation Technology Center Incorporated, or TTCI. This is a group that came in to the Metro North system, particularly on the New Haven line first, brought very sophisticated technologic equipment in to do radar, ground-penetrating radar, track geometry, to completely diagnose the entire network in New Haven, on the New Haven line. They also came in to look at the track department at Metro North, and they came in to look at the safety culture and some of the other safety practices. That process has gone on with a diagnostic effort, and I'm pleased to say that almost all of the things that were found have been completed. State of Connecticut has invested upwards of $18 million since May in improvements in the right-of-way. These are things, by the way, that were found over and above the normal federal required inspections. So Metro North far exceeds the inspections and safety standards for Federal Railroad Administration. They went above that yet again with new equipment. So let me just talk a little bit about what they've done to give a sense of the magnitude. Yeah. On the New Haven line, we've put in about 8,000 new ties, six new switches, rehabilitated 36 poor drainage areas. We welded over 41 compromised joints. The compromised joint is the failure in Bridgeport.
Yeah.
We welded 72 straight joints.
I'm just going to stop you quickly. Before you get to too many statistics, because I want to make sure, for our broad audience that doesn't understand a lot of this stuff, some may listen to that and say, well, that's good. They're making needed upgrades, service improvements, changes. Others might say, well, isn't that what you're supposed to be doing all the time? I mean, on a consistent basis, improvements to the rails, to switches, to everything that makes a railroad run, including safety training for people who are part of the personnel mix. There is a question that a lot of people have: is this stuff that should have been done all along? Mm-hmm. Is Connecticut and is Metro North in its own way investing enough throughout the course of the last several years? And does a major change need to happen now?
Well, so all of these investments that are being made are actually addressing higher standards than the railroads require. And that's a proactive step on the part of Metro North to get us above what I would consider to be normal state of good repair. Our program today keeps us maintained on track and signals and overhead wires at what I would consider to be a state of good repair. Now, these investments take us to a better state. They're to protect us even more in terms of safety and to give us an environment where the infrastructure will allow service improvements. We're targeting – there's still work to be done. I don't want to dismiss that. We have work to be done that will not be done. A good section of it still to occur in the spring. There's a four-track section in the Bronx that was completely rebuilt, but one track out of four still has to be done. So that's not going to happen until the spring. And then a few more actions to take us actually through to the summer. But Metro North is committed to working with us on removing slow orders that were put in place to do all this work, bringing service back to what we had anticipated. I must say that the latest incident that occurred in New York, where they asked to have conductors in cab cars are communicating and putting in other restrictions, actually will have another negative impact until we can fix all those things.
Another negative impact in terms of service?
In terms of speed, yeah.
In terms of speed.
Yeah, to comply with the latest order from Federal Railroad, some speeds have to be reduced.
Well, and here's we're talking with Jim Redeker. He's the commissioner of the state DOT. And if you want to join us, 860-275-7266. We're talking about Metro North. Off the top of the program, I mentioned that it is in many ways a thankless job because if we say we want the safest, best-maintained railroad, that means things might have to slow down for a while. If it slows down for a while, people say, well, it's too slow. You mentioned this idea of slow service. This is something that came up over the course of the last week when we did another program, slow orders. And we had on State Representative Gail Laviel, who follows these issues very closely for her constituents, talking about the necessary repairs being made to Metro North, but also the lack of communication regarding these repairs. Let's just listen to what she had to say.
If this is being done as a necessity, which it is, then that ought to be communicated better by Metro North to the commuters. And I've made that point many times to the DOT. The DOT sort of gets it. Metro North consistently doesn't perform in terms of communication.
So that's State Representative Gail Laviel on our show last week. And I think that's really the point. It came up from her. It came up from Jim Cameron, the rail advocate who we talk to regularly. And what they're essentially saying is, if everyone lets people know what's happening with the trains, then they know they're going to run slow and they know why they're running slow. But over and over again, they're saying their constituents are not being communicated with enough, so they just see slow trains and they still worry about the safety.
Sure. So let me do two things. First, the reason that I would that I appreciate going through what's been invested in is that I'm ready to, my position is that this railroad is in better shape than it has been in any time. And we need to say that, and we need to get that word out. I've also just spent a long time over the weekend, yet again, because of the Federal Railroad orders with the Metro North, time spent with President Howard Permit and Chief Executive Officer Tom Prendergast talking about just this. What is the schedule of events that are going to take place? What's still left to be done? When can we guarantee customers that service will return? They will be providing a report to me, sort of a year-end, close out the derailment. what we've done, and when are we going to see the improvements that customers deserve. I must admit that I come from a customer service background. My 30 years at New Jersey Transit focused a lot on customers. I advocate for aggressive communication, factual communication, fast communication, because customers deserve that. By the way, they get it immediately anyway. And unless we're providing factual information, it gets filled with errors and erroneous things. And I think that's exactly what's happened, which has caused what I consider somewhat of a breach of public confidence right now.
Mm-hmm.
Two derailments and an electric outage and an employee death, talking about a culture of an organization that, you must admit, when you put it all together, seems that way. From an infrastructure point of view, I can say that we have addressed the infrastructure issues. Metro North has done a terrific job and done it to standards above any other railroad. What they haven't yet done is commit to the schedule. And I think part of that is this unexpected Federal Railroad order last Friday really threw a loop into the process. It is once more going to say we've got to put some more slow orders in until we do more things. So they're working through that. They're working through it hard. I'm very impressed with the way they've tackled all the challenges that they've had. But I do think that communication is going to be critical. I'm advocating, with them, a report out to customers that once and for all says you can be confident in this railroad. It is safe. We're doing everything we can to make it safe, and we will continue to do that. The other part of it is that Metro North has done an extraordinary change in what I consider or label safety culture. They've taken this very seriously. They've tripled the staff in their safety operation. They've done safety stand downs. They're training their employees in safety. And it gets to making sure that every day when a person goes to work and starts their job, and throughout that day, the first and only focus is on safety. And sometimes things will be sacrificed for that. But that is critical. And they're taking steps to drive that organization into the safety culture that it needs to be.
Do you think that the federal order that came last week, you said it put a kink in the works, it made things maybe go a little slower. Do you think that that was warranted, though?
I think, everybody wants to make sure the railroad's safe. The idea that this was an engineer who fell asleep, essentially. And how do you protect for that? There are technical answers. There are technical devices that are in most but not all of the trains, and Metro North will put those in as fallbacks. The idea that that what they're doing now is having engineers and conductors communicate at these places where speeds go from a high speed to a slower speed to be sure that everyone's awake and aware. That takes some time, and it will put some slowness into the system. But there's a commitment to get it all retrofitted, all the equipment retrofitted, so we can eliminate these additional slow orders. So that schedule is what's getting put together so we can, together with Metro North, communicate all the actions taken and the return to service that people deserve, as in prior to the derailment, and frankly, maybe better because of the investments we've made.
So here's another thing that we hear from people, and we heard a lot on the show the other week, not enough trains to serve all the people that want to go in and out of the city.
Yeah.
Many of these trains, whether the fancy new cars or the old cars that have a little wear on the edges, they're filled up with people.
Mm-hmm.
I've been on trains packed like a sardine coming back at peak hour.
Sure.
Do we need to run more trains to serve the number of people who want to use the railroad?
What we need to do is run the right number of trains, not necessarily more, just to put more out. There's a balance, I think, between making sure we serve the demand, attract more customers, because that's our goal.
Absolutely.
To carry as
yeah.
many people as possible. And at the same time, run the most efficient railroad that we can. And by the way, the Metro North New Haven line is the most cost-efficient railroad, commuter railroad, in the country, to the credit of people looking at this. Now, what I should say, and I don't think people are aware, that the purchase of the M8 cars isn't just predicated on replacing old equipment that had to be replaced, but there's an increase in capacity of 30% by the time we finish that order, which is looking ahead toward the growth that we need. And the other part of this is that some of the capacity that we're actually building, and I want to get back to that for a minute, is not just in the New York direction, but in the reverse direction. There are more people coming to Stamford than leaving Stamford going to New York. This last year, and I want to be clear about it, in this past year, we added more service on the New Haven line than any time in the New Haven line history. So we have taken proactive steps. The good news is we're getting the demand filling those seats. So we'll continue to do that as we move forward.
But when you say it's the most cost efficient, you're talking about the right number of trains, not necessarily more trains. Then we hear people who commute all the time saying, but the rates are pretty high. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you say it's the most cost efficient way to run a railroad, people are riding on trains that aren't getting them there on time, and they're riding on trains that are packed with too many people, and they say they're paying too much for it. So from a commuter standpoint, they say, Commissioner, something here has to give. A cheaper train that's packed to the gills might make sense for me. A train that doesn't run on time quite as much might be okay if I'm communicated better with. You understand the point, and that's the commuter conundrum. They hear you say that this is an efficient railroad, but they don't see that on the ground.
Well, so I think we have to be careful about what's fact and what's not.
Okay, yeah.
Because this is a railroad that is known for its on-time performance, and historically, I mean, until we put some of these orders in since May, and May has been the troubled period.
Yes.
It was intentional. It was purposeful. It was communicated, but not frequently enough. I mean, there were notices put on the website, notices put on the seats, notices put out in tweets, and sometimes people just don't get them all the time. And then they, you know, pretend that they didn't come out, perhaps. But I would say this. When you make those investments, we have a railroad that is known for 98% on-time performance. It is known for being very cost-effective. And it is a reliable system that people depend on. The capacity issue is one we manage all the time. And, you know, we change schedules every period, you know, every quarter or so to try to meet that demand. If sometimes in the meantime we don't, or there happens to be a big event and it's crowded, I will say that, you know, customers deserve a huge amount of credit for what they've put up with and lived through in this since the derailment. My hope is that we're over that. We're over that on the New Haven line, and now we're trying to address these new orders. Because, by the way, the FRA orders, I think, were intended to deal with the derailment in New York. Mm-hmm. But they had this unintended consequence of impacting the New Haven line significantly. So we're going to work through that. We're going to get rid of those issues and then return the service to the reliability and the performance that they deserve. And I think customers just need to know when that's going to happen.
When you come back from a break, and we'll continue talking about Metro North, of course, if you have questions at 860-275-7266. But the Department of Transportation deals with roads and bridges and so much else. We want to get to a number of different things, including some initiatives that they have. If you want to join our conversation, 860-275-7266. You can email wherewelive at WNPR.org or tweet us at wherewelive. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today, our guest is Jim Redeker. He's the commissioner of the Department of Transportation. We're going to take your calls and questions. Emails are wherewelive at WNPR.org. You can call us at 860-275-7266. We've been talking about Metro North. Of course, we will get more questions about that. We'll also be talking about the roads and bridges. Let's quickly go to John. Hi, John. Go ahead. John, are you there? We'll put John on hold and see if we can gather him back in. I-84 in Hartford, the busiest highway in the state with 175,000 vehicles every day. The average age of bridges in our state is about 50 years, and a lot of these bridges are just designed to last 50 years. Yeah, there are a lot of things to talk about right now. Let's go through some of these. There is a perception, as we said before, that Metro North needs some improvements. There's also always a perception that Connecticut interstates, highways, parkways are in bad shape. Rusty bridges, potholes, that sort of thing. What do you see as the state of Connecticut's highways from where you sit? Obviously, you're hoping that your department's doing a good job. Maybe you can talk to us about what you're doing well and some places that maybe you're not doing so well.
Sure. I'm not just hoping we're doing well. We are doing well. Let me just start with some major projects, because I think they are exemplary of the kind of organization that we are today. You know that we're investing in the Q Bridge, $2 billion project. It is consistently ahead of schedule. It's $200 million and more under budget. We're investing in the Moses Wheeler Bridge, $750 million. It's a three-span bridge. The first span was done a year ahead of schedule. We're taking a look at different ways to do projects. We have to replace a major bridge in Stamford called the Atlantic Street Bridge, which is the railroad bridge that carries the Northeast Corridor over Atlantic Street. That was supposed to be a bridge not completed till 2024 and take years of taking Metro North and Amtrak tracks out of service. Instead, we've come with a solution that can replace the bridges two bridges over a weekend each, and do that by 2016. So we're looking at new ways to deliver programs, looking at accelerated bridge construction, looking at ways to save money, to improve our processes, to turn around things, which does two things. One, it eliminates delays for customers, right? It shortens the time of project implementation. It also brings it in cheaper. We reprogram that money. We get more done. So that's the Department of Transportation these days. In terms of the condition of the roadway system, you know, a lot of people have perceptions or they take surveys about what the system is like.
Yes.
We do serious, you know, analysis of our systems. And I can tell you that we look at every single rail bridge and every single highway bridge. We've got 4,000 highway bridges in the state. We've got 300 rail system bridges. About 8% of those are in what we rate as poor. And every one of those bridges is either under construction or in design. So as the system gets to this aging and gets to a condition, we don't really worry so much about age. It's really about how is it performing. And we go out and check every one of them. We inspect them. We rate them. And as soon as they need work, they move into the design stage and then into construction.
And I'll stop you really quick because, I mean, we had reported on this. The AP did this this study about bridge safety across America. They say more than 500 bridges in Connecticut are considered structurally deficient. More than 200 are fracture critical. I'm not sure exactly what that means. Connecticut has 49 bridges that are both structurally deficient and fracture critical. When you talk about 8% of the 4,000 bridges, 500 to me sounds like a higher number than 8%. Yeah. I mean, do you dismiss this study?
No. It's about terms. When you think about fracture critical, that just means this, the design it says that if a particular member were to be broken, that the bridge would come down. Now, we have some of those. There's bridges all over the country and all over the world like that. It doesn't mean they're not safe. Mm-hmm. That's an example of the bridge out in Washington where a truck hit the bridge and it came down. That's a fracture critical bridge. Well, you can't avoid a truck driver doing the wrong thing, you know, in an accident mode. We don't want that to happen, but we make sure that our bridges are safe. Frankly, the measure of safety is if a bridge cannot support the weight of the truck traffic in Connecticut or the safety of it, we post it. We say not safe to drive or lower speeds or certain types of vehicles can't go over. We don't have any bridges posted in Connecticut. The poor condition is how we do our business. We measure constantly and we put bridges into our program to make sure that they are rehabilitated or replaced on the right schedule. Now, our pavement, I would put up against any state. In the last 5 years, we have repaved almost 70% of the state highway network. Now, there's the difference between the state and local, and local roads and bridges have significant need as well. One of the things that happened in this administration in the governor's budget was giving local bridges $15 million of state money more and another $45 million that is strictly a grant to towns to be able to get work done quickly because you recognize that it's not just the state system but also the local system that needs work. So, we are serious about management systems to take a look at all of our infrastructure. We rate it. We take a look at the condition. Age has a piece to do with it, but age isn't necessarily the measure of performance.
I want to get to some phone calls. People are calling about trains and buses and cars. Let's go to Trish in Clinton. Hi, Trish. Hi, Trish. Are you there? My goodness, we're having problems with the phones today. Let me try back with John in Meriden and see if he's around this time. John, are you there? All right. We're going to go make sure that our phones are in a little bit better shape, and we'll get to some questions here. Judy on Facebook, when will it be as easy to get to Bradley Airport from New Haven area by public transportation as it is to get to LaGuardia and JFK airports?
Oh, it's going to be much easier to get to Bradley very soon than it is to get to LaGuardia or JFK. As you know, we're investing in the program we call New Haven, Hartford, Springfield, intercity and high-speed rail. We are putting several hundred million dollars of state money as well as federal money from that program into the corridor from New Haven to Springfield. That'll change in 2016 from a service that is slow, unreliable, and six trains a day that don't get you anywhere to 16 trains a day in each direction in 2016 with a dedicated connection from Windsor Locks to Bradley Airport. It'll have a concierge-type service, red cap-type service. We'll post the times for all the flights. You'll get right to your terminal, and every single train will be met to get you to and from. In fact, it'll be a terrific service, and it's a key component, I think, of why State of Connecticut was successful in achieving that federal grant for the high-speed rail money, in part because of the intermodal connections. It connects to Bradley Airport. It will connect to Connecticut Fast Track. It connects to the New Haven Line. It gets you to Boston. So that investment that we're making now, aggressively moving forward on, will bring the state of Connecticut in the I-91 corridor a rail service that is one of the premier services. And the state is going to benefit from that economically.
When does it happen? I mean, when is it done? 2016. It's done in 2016.
Service in 2016.
Including stations and all the places that are supposed to have stations?
Absolutely. So we're rebuilding all the Amtrak stations. In the future, we have plans to moving forward with some towns to add some commuter stops. But all of the current Amtrak stops will be rebuilt with high-level platforms, accessible systems, new parking. We're upgrading right now. The signal system is pretty well done. We're doing some track work, and we'll be aggressively moving into brand-new track and then the station construction so that by the end of 2016, we'll be running the service.
If you want to ask a question of DOT Commissioner James Redeker, why don't you send us a tweet at Where We Live, or you can email us wherewelive@wnpr.org. We're trying to fix a little phone problem, and we'd love to get some of your questions in here, but we can't do that if the phones aren't working. Email from Eric, who says, can the Connecticut bus system implement the GPS app for their buses in Hartford and New Haven? There are a few cities in the country that do this system. It would be very helpful for riders.
Absolutely. We are. We will. 2015. We are rolling out the system first with CT Fast Track because it's our premier service. That'll be opening in February. Right after that in the spring, we'll roll out the GPS real-time information for customers with, you know, real-time applications, bus stop location indicators, those kind of things.
So somebody with a phone app will be able to tell when their bus is going to arrive.
Yeah, absolutely. They'll know what it's scheduled for, where it actually is. They could get alerts for it and subscribe to that. We're actually proud of the fact that and pleased that we've got for CT Fast Track, we've engaged the students at CCSU. Several student groups are working with us, one on marketing, one on communications, but one in particular developing applications strictly for CT Fast Track. But the need for this system is, I think, imperative. People expect that kind of information. Connecticut's behind. We're finally going to catch up, and with the combination of a new radio system and this new GPS technology in 2015, we'll finally meet the current standards we should be operating at.
Give us an update on CT Fast Track. For people who don't know, this is what we're calling the busway from New Britain to Hartford. It's something that has been controversial. Obviously, if you live in this area, you see signs of it going up. There's a lot of people who have questions. Some people are anxiously awaiting it. Where are we right now with Fast Track?
Great. So thanks for calling it Fast Track and not the busway. We've rebranded.
We go back and forth.
We have a jar in the office. If you say busway, you have to put a quarter in it. But it's important. People understand it's not just a 9.5 mile roadway between New Britain and Hartford. It is a network and a system. We finished a whole summer's worth of outreach to communities and are redoing the entire service plan. That concept will get people as far as Waterbury, Southington, Cheshire, a direct service onto Fast Track, into Hartford, circulate around, door-to-door service. It'll be fast. It'll save time. With all kinds of circulators, connectors, special loops to hospitals and schools, it's really going to be, I think, game-changing for that corridor. We are today at just over 50% of the project expenditures and construction. You will see dramatic changes. Station facilities are in. We've got landscaping actually done in some places. The multi-use trail has segments built. You can almost drive on about 80% of that new alignment. And we were giving tours and we're doing things like that. What I think is rather important is a couple perceptions. One is this engagement of students, particularly college students, who recognize that this is an opportunity to be able to connect an entire regional transportation network. You'll be able to connect to the Waterbury line in Waterbury or to the high-speed rail link in Hartford or in a couple other places you can connect in to get on buses. You can get anywhere you need to go. So from CT Fast Track, you can get to New York City or Boston or any place in Connecticut without owning a car. That's also having an impact on developers who are keenly interested in transit-oriented development. For example, the National Welding Site in Newington is a prime place where developers want to come in and put in a development right at the stop because they know that this is a place where people, particularly young people who want to live and work in Connecticut, could live there and not have to own a car. And for those who are sort of entering that job market, the price of a car is about the same as $120,000 mortgage. So you can afford to buy a house if you don't have a car. Mm-hmm. And we're providing that kind of a system with CT Fast Track. So we are on schedule. Our date is still February 2015. And that is a system which will not only have this broad service approach, which is, by the way, changeable. We can move and serve markets very quickly. But it is going to bring the latest technology in terms of real-time bus location as well as fare technology, onboard Wi-Fi, everything that you'd want to have in a sleek and modern system.
Obviously, with any big project like this, there are going to be some very specific concerns. There has been one that we've covered on our air before about a road closure in Hartford that some people say is unfairly cutting off a section of town from the Farmington Avenue corridor up where the Aetna is down to the Frog Hollow neighborhood. There's been a lawsuit about whether or not this is going to be safe for pedestrians and bicyclers. How are you going to address this specific local concerns and other local concerns about this project as they move forward? Essentially, people are saying, we got to find some way to get down the street. We're closing it for this busway, and it's making our lives much more difficult.
Sure. So we're going to solve it the way we solve all other problems. We sit down and dialogue and work with the community. And we made that commitment, both the residential community and the business community. But back to the exact issue. This is about safety. And this is about a grade crossing where it is not safe to have people cross at grade. And it's closed now for construction. It will stay closed. But what we're seeking is alternatives for people so that they can get where they need to get safely. So, for example, we've built a brand new pedestrian path as a bypass to this. And we've also rebuilt the Broad Street Bridge. And on the Broad Street Bridge is wide sidewalks. And we are have striped it for a bus bicycle lane. All of that to get people the mobility and the connections they want. Now, at the same time, we've engaged a design team with the community to look at options for pedestrian, we call them up and overs. They're all different places. They do exist in other ways. And we want to make sure that that's a commitment we made to bring that forward, to address a design possibility and have the community weigh in on that. And so it's about community engagement, commitments that we've made. But above and beyond everything is if we're going to keep a system safe, and safety is our number one priority, we can't do it by keeping that particular road open. That may be unfortunate for some in terms of what they had before. I think when we're all said and done, the betterments that CT Fast Track brings to that specific community and what the DOT will commit to and deliver in terms of pedestrian treatments and systems will be better and meet the needs of the community.
Now, in that very area, before we take our break, I want to let our listeners know we're talking with Jim Redeker. He's the commissioner of the DOT. Our phone system is down right now. We're taking some of your calls that would normally be calls through emails and tweets, so send them to us at Where We Live. As we talk about that particular region of the world, up above that very area is what we call, and Aetna doesn't like it when we call it this, the Aetna Viaduct.
No, we don't call it that.
I can call it the I-84 Viaduct. I can call that. I know that there's probably a jar in your office when people call it the Aetna Viaduct, but it's the I-84 Viaduct. It is a very, very busy roadway, and it is a roadway that is not necessarily in need of repair. It's in need of rethinking. Can you explain where we are in this long-term process and project of figuring out how to either replace or completely demolish and reimagine what we call the Aetna Viaduct here in Hartford, but many people think of as the I-84 raised roadway?
Correct. So it is a roadway system, a bridge system, which will need to be replaced. And so it is on our schedule. And so recognizing that down the road, we're going to have to do something significant here. We've got it into a significant planning and environmental study right now in design that began with the city of Hartford engaging in a series of community outreach programs where really a new Hartford was envisioned, where the steel structure could be lowered, put at grade. We could rebuild the downtown and the city connections. When we looked at that, it also could mean that the railroad could be realigned. In fact, to its historic location, not weaving and winding through Hartford slowly, but rather going quickly to perhaps a new facility. What's interesting is that the combined projects of rebuilding the railroad and the old viaduct for the railroad, mm-hmm. as well as the viaduct for the highway, are billions of dollars.
Yes.
Maybe $3 billion. This concept that came out of the community has the potential to perhaps save up to $1 billion. So we're serious about it. We have kicked off a process which has community people, stakeholder engagement, and leadership involved in decision making. Our current schedule takes us through some preliminary design, environmental work, and a record of decision by 2017, which then gets us poised to make a decision of which way do we go, what design works, when do we need to get it done, how do we pay for it, and what is the type of mechanism we want to do to deliver that project. So we have a time because we have to do a fairly significant engineering and environmental work. But 2017 is when we believe we'll be ready to make the decision on what we're going to do and when.
And that when would be just, and we have to take a break here, but just roughly when? So we make a decision 2017, we've got a new highway going through Hartford at what time?
Yeah, so we don't know. I mean, it really depends on what options we come upon and what construction and delivery techniques are possible to deliver that. And we won't know that until we get further through the design and environmental efforts.
We're talking with Jim Redeker of the DOT. He's the commissioner. When we come back, we'll take more of your questions. We've got a lot more to talk about. It's snowing outside in Connecticut right now. And we always think about the DOT when we think about snowy roads. People have questions about that. You can join us. Send your email to wherewelive@wnpr.org, or you can tweet us at wherewelive. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, a state court threw out convictions on corruption charges that would have sent former Hartford Mayor Eddie Paris to prison. Connecticut withdrew its appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court in a case involving state unions and former Governor John Rowland. Those are just a few of the stories that we will cover in tomorrow's Where We Live as we bring Colin McEnroe, as usual, into the wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. I hope you can join us. Today, we're talking with DOT Commissioner James Redeker. He joins us in studio today. Our phone system, sadly, has broken on us. Maybe not enough maintenance and repair. We'll see. Emails wherewelive@wnpr.org or tweets at wherewelive are being happily accepted right now. So we're going to do a rapid fire last segment with you here, Jim. Let's go to this. Shelley writes about winter driving. What's actually put down on the roads? Will it in long run only not only damage cars, but the environment too?
Let's talk about that a bit. The DOT has a practice and a policy of looking at constantly looking at best practices for safety and snow and ice removal. And I'd put our program up against any and call us best in class at the moment. We actually put down far less chemicals and salt than our neighbors, about a third less than Massachusetts. We do that intentionally with an eye toward the environment and an eye toward what it does to equipment and to vehicles. But above all, we have to be safe. It is our job to maintain a safe and open network so people can get where they need to go and do that safely. We change our program every year as we look at what best practices are. So this year, we are applying salt. We're putting magnesium chloride down as well. That mixture tends to address the problems quickly. It does some pre-melting when necessary. It cleans it up quickly. And we cycle our vehicles, on a regular basis to stay up with the conditions. Today, for example, we've got all of our 600 and some plows out. Our entire workforce is ready and out and about. We've got over 200 private contractors ready to call in. We monitor by the minute and make sure that we keep our roads open and safe. And this year, on top of that, I'm pleased to say that, and it's because of last year's huge snowstorm, we've invested for the first time in six huge snowblowers, which helped us clear. We borrowed them from other states in the big snowstorm last year and realized that it was a piece of our technology that we needed to upgrade. So we've got new technology, a slightly new set of chemical treatments, but all of that is done in partnership with DEEP, our regulators, and we make sure that we comply with all the laws.
We never used to worry so much about the trees roadside, but we have in the last couple of years. We got a few emails just now. Francis says, Connecticut DOT says they're performing tree maintenance on 91 North from Meriden to Cromwell. Far more than maintenance, it's clear cutting run amok. Terry in Stamford says, we're watching sadly as scores of trees bordering the Merritt Parkway are being cut down. Do you have plans for landscaping the cleared land? We're running low on time, so just a quick answer on what are we doing with trees right now along Connecticut's highways?
We're doing what we should have done for 30 years and did not, which is maintain a clear right-of-way. So from a snowstorm or a windstorm or a hurricane and or from a safety perspective, we've got a clear zone where cars, if they go off the road, either have a guardrail or a clear zone. And in the case of a storm, we don't have trees falling on the road because we've had to close our highways as trees come down. the Merritt in particular, but 91 as well. We are doing what should have been done for 30 years. We just never had the money.
You have a program called Transform Connecticut. On a show like this, we take in a lot of information from listeners and try to get you ideas. This is something you're doing to try to gather input from people.
Yeah.
Tell us exactly what this is.
Sure. Actually, this is the governor's initiative. He asked that we launch a program to create a 50-year vision for transportation in Connecticut. So we called it Transform CT. We are transforming the way we do that. Typically, DOT holds a couple meetings, evening meetings. We get input. People write letters or emails, and we respond, and we do that. This is a very interactive technology we're using. You can get on the transformct.org. I encourage everybody to do that. We currently have over 60,000 people who have touched our website, and on a regular basis, over 6,000 to 8,000 people interacting with us. And we will be posing questions. We will be providing alternatives. In the end, this is the first strategic plan for the DOT ever. It will be shaped by Connecticut, not by the DOT. We will be doing a look at how to make choices with very detailed economic and cost-benefit models to say, what should we be doing and what are the benefits of doing that for the economy of the state of Connecticut? And at the same time, as we look at what we want to do, what's most important to do economically, we will be looking at what does the DOT need to do to change itself to be the kind of an organization that responds to customers, gets the job done, and what do we need to be able to deliver that program? It's intended to get results out for public consumption and decision-making in about 18 months, but we encourage everyone who listens to come in, take a look at the website, sign up, get alerts, get information. We're excited about it. It's the first time we've done this kind of a thorough plan.
And a lot of our listeners who love these transportation issues, I'm sure, can find a way to get involved in that. We just have a little bit of time left. I know that you have a new distracted driving program, but I want to read an email from Christine that kind of goes with that. She says, I'm concerned about distractions caused by bright and flashing electronic billboards being installed along the highways. They're often placed at points where one has to make a decision to go this way or that. I think they're just as distracting and dangerous as texting. As we try to crack down on people using their phones in the cars, Jim Redeker, there's an awful lot on our roadside that seems to be, well, just like the stuff that's in our hand. That's what Christine's talking about. How do we tackle both these things together?
Yeah, so two parts of that. One is Federal Highway Administration recognizes that, you know, blinking, flashing, electronic signs can be a distraction, which is frankly why the safety signs don't flash any other messages. Private billboards on the side of the road are things that, you know, may not be around for a long time just simply because, you know, they are distractions and other things. They may not be the right investment in terms of revenues for the state of Connecticut, but I appreciate the issue. Distracted driving is critical. And yesterday, the DOT kicked off first ever program for distracted driving in high schools. We will be going to 30 high schools this year with a simulator systems, two simulators for distracted texting, a simulator for drunk driving with a compelling video program to get high school students before and while they're learning to drive not to do it distracted. It is such a compelling issue. It needs to be a program such that when you get in your car, you put it, you put your cell phone down just like you put your seatbelt on, and people are not doing that. It is a crisis ready to happen, and we're committed as our number one program this year to doing this kind of outreach and doing it through the schools because we hope students will educate their parents and their relatives.
You're going to appreciate me asking Julie's question from Hartford. This is a question that you have about 30 seconds to answer. Are we going to use toll booths as a source for generating dollars to improve our infrastructure?
We are investigating tolls aggressively. We have two federal grants looking at that, both in Hartford and on Southwest Connecticut. It's obviously something we don't do right now. It's something a lot of other states do. We want to be the group that can inform the decision makers, the legislators, the governor's office about what the potential is, when it could work, if it could work, and what the downsides and the positives are. We think that that's another year or a year and a half away from decision making, but we're providing all the analysis to get us ready.
And if the money comes in from tolls at some point, then that's money that you'd actually be able to use, not money that would magically go into the general fund?
Well, let's hope we'll use it, but we've had lots of money to spend and we're doing it well.
Jim Redeker is the commissioner of the state DOT. Thank you so much for coming in and answering all these questions. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. The opportunity has been great.
And safe driving on the roadways today. If you want to continue this conversation, go to our website. It's WNPR.org, and you can continue that conversation with your thoughts. You can also tweet us at Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Our program is produced by Tucker Ives. The senior producer is Katie Talarski. Tomorrow, it's The Wheelhouse with Colin McEnroe, our weekly news roundtable.